This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
When big systems flip into another state, that is trouble for species needing normal, like us. We get the latest on global tipping points in 2023 from one of the world's top experts, Professor Tim Lenton from Exeter University. Then we explore Earth energy imbalance at the poles with Hamish Prince and Greenlash, backward steps in the European Union. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Large-scale, rapid climate change may be the biggest threat to humanity and life as we know it. Earth systems may not change gradually at a steady rate, but could bounce into a new state with no return. The point of time when a shift is determined and unstoppable is called a tipping point. Right at the center of tipping point research is Dr. Timothy Lenton. At the University of Exeter, he is chair in climate change and earth system science. Lenton is lead author of the new Global Tipping Points Report for 2023. This is what we know so far. From Exeter, UK, Tim Lenton, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me back at the program.
We last talked in 2020 about the report Climate Tipping Points Too Risky to Bet Against. In the new Global Tipping Report for 2023, I see a change, because in the earlier interview you said, almost quietly, you feared at least one tipping point had already been crossed. 4 years later, with a torrent of new science, are we more certain and are more tipping points already in play?
Yes, unfortunately, I think we identify up to five that might be already in play or already crossed, and the whole catalogue of ones that we could cross has unfortunately grown considerably. And yeah, we know we're at risk, for example, for large-scale dieback and loss of coral reefs, which we're tragically seeing happening again live right now. Yeah, and alongside that, there are a couple of major ice sheets, West Antarctica and Greenland, at clear risk, and parts of the frozen soils of the north, the permafrost, thawing abruptly. Yeah, and then there's a part of the circulation of the ocean in the North Atlantic that we see worrying signs of being close to a tipping point.
Yes, and when I talked to Matthew England in Australia, he said that the Antarctic polar bottom, the circulation there, had already tipped, in his opinion.
Exactly. So it was last year, 2023, had these most extraordinary deviations of ocean surface temperatures in large regions, as well as extraordinary extent of fires, for example, across the Canadian boreal forest. So in short, some shocking and surprising things are going on in the climate system that even specialists like us would really struggle to attribute to just being part of some kind of smooth overall change of the climate. Instead, we see this growing evidence of possibly abrupt and possibly irreversible changes, tipping points.
Posts on social media tell us many people do not understand ecological tipping points. They believe that polar ice ends all of a sudden or species go extinct at the tipping point. What is the reality between the point of tipping and its final destination?
Well, that's a great question that kind of depends on the system and its own timescales. I think as a kid I was kind of taught, well, if you lived in the life of a fly, humans would seem like this very, very slow thing, whereas to us, the fly is this very fast thing that lives short and dies. In the Earth as a system, ice sheets are really slow things compared to a human time scale, whereas the circulation of the atmosphere and the weather is a really fast thing, like the fly, compared to a human time scale. So fast things can tip fast, like the atmosphere. Really slow things, like the ice sheets, they may tip. It may be very hard to reverse the loss of an ice sheet, but that doesn't mean it feels or seems or unfolds quickly for humans. So, yeah, there are big differences. We might pass the tipping point for an ice sheet, but have watched the consequences unfold for several centuries, whereas if we tip a bit of one of the monsoons in the tropics, maybe we see the difference from one year to the next. And when it comes to ecology that you mentioned, well, actually, it's an interesting mix. Sometimes, if you imagined a scenario like tipping the loss of a large chunk of the Amazon rainforest, that probably, at least in models, takes the order of a decade to unfold. Although individual trees can be killed quickly by individual drought events or fires. So yeah, it's kind of all about scales and the natural time scales of things.
So the Potsdam Institute, the Stockholm Resilience Center, your own group at Exeter raised even more worrying possibilities. Tipping points do not operate in a vacuum, and they might influence one another. Can you give us an example of how tipping points might cascade?
Yeah, so in the Arctic, we see unprecedented warming, I mean, 3 or 4 times as fast as the rest of the planet. That is to do with replacing a highly reflective white sea ice surface with a really dark sunlight-absorbing ocean surface, which in itself, parts of that might be a tipping point. But that extra Arctic warming means a couple of things. It's contributing to the accelerated melt and potential tipping of the Greenland ice sheet, and that's a source of fresh water that pours off the ice sheet into the neighbouring bits of the North Atlantic Ocean. The warmer Arctic is also meaning more snow and rain in the Arctic, which is also like a source of fresh water into the surface ocean. And fresh water pouring into the surface ocean of the North Atlantic can disrupt a crucial process where the surface waters get cold and salty enough and therefore dense enough to sink from the top to the bottom of the ocean. And if you stop that process, which we call deep convection, it can stop the great overturning circulation of the Atlantic Ocean, which drags a huge amount of heat from the southern hemisphere across the equator into the northern hemisphere, especially into the North Atlantic region. So if you stop that circulation, it has some other major knock-on effects. It moves the band of rainfall around the whole tropic that rings the tropics of the planet southwards. That means it could seriously disrupt the monsoon in West Africa, in India, and also over South America, including the Amazon. And shutting off the ocean circulation, or that part of it, can leave basically heat behind in the Southern Ocean, where it could go to work to melt the West Antarctic ice sheet and parts of the East Antarctic ice sheet. And in that way, it's a cascade of possible tipping points from one pole, the Arctic, to the other, the Antarctic.
Tim Linton, you also worked on early warning signs that a system may be destabilizing, and that seems like very important information to have if we can get it. What have we learned?
Actually, the last few years have seen a bevy of recent research on these early warning signs for tipping points. What we've learned is that there are signs that several of these big systems are showing that they're losing stability and that they are heading in the direction of a tipping point. That doesn't necessarily tell us how close, but it tells us we're heading in the wrong direction, and that's for a key part of the Greenland ice sheet. It's for the great overturning circulation of the Atlantic that I just mentioned, and it's also for, in our own research, the Amazon rainforest. We see clear signal of destabilization, and this signal that's common across the systems, the early warning signal, is that before you get to a tipping point, a system gets less good at recovering from the little shocks it might be getting from the world, perturbations we call them in science, and it recovers more slowly from perturbations. It might also undergo a bigger change when given the same size of little shock. Yeah, we detect those early warning signals consistently across those systems, and in fact, almost every week now, a paper seems to be coming out, or every month at least, a paper's coming out with more of this kind of evidence. Several of them for this great overturning circulation of the Atlantic, which is arguably the biggest tipping point.
Is there only one tipping point for each big process, like ice melt, or thousands of ice tipping points in 1,000 locations?
Well, that's a great question as well, because certainly for if you think of something like coral reefs, there are lots of different reefs, and they certainly individual reefs can have their individual tipping point. And then it becomes a question about whether some sort of heat wave in the ocean can be over a sufficiently large area that it tips a much bigger area of reef, like the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. And as you mentioned, ice sheets, it's also when you study in detail ice sheets like the ones on East and West Antarctica, you find, oh yes, well, major glaciers could each have their own tipping point, but then if you lose one big glacier, it can destabilize the next one in a kind of cascade. And earlier this year, I and a bunch of colleagues started writing about this sort of view of, I don't know if you want to call it nested tipping or something like that, but how tipping phenomena can sometimes spread out from smaller scales, again cascading over bits of an ice sheet or whatever, to larger scales.
And then we have the human influence, because one of the key points in the new report, quote, is the effects of tipping points will be transmitted and amplified throughout our globalized world. Could you talk about that, Tim?
The worrying interpretation of that, of course, is, let's take a scenario like the one I mentioned of a tipping of the Atlantic's overturning circulation. It's known as the AMOC for short. Well, we calculated, okay, what would this do for the area on which we could grow major staple crops like wheat and maize worldwide? And we quickly found out that it could halve, or more than halve, the area upon which you could grow those major staple crops. Well, you don't have to be a scientist or a genius to see that if you halve the area to grow wheat and maize worldwide, which are two of the major staple crops, we're going to have some food security issues. We'll certainly have a drastic rise in price of wheat and maize because of a supply-demand balance shift. Whether it would literally mean people starving because food became too expensive, well, we know that in just the last decade or so, when wheat prices go up, this tends to cause rioting and social unrest. And many authors attribute the so-called Arab Spring to rising grain prices and food prices. But that would be mild compared to what you'd get if you had this big-scale tipping point, which would also be not a one-off event, but pretty much irreversible. So in that sense, we're talking about social tipping dynamics, like when people got out on the streets protesting in the Arab Spring against their leaders, partly agitated by the fact that, you know, they couldn't afford to feed themselves. Well, when you have a political protest that escalates, or even a political revolution it might result in, that's a classic case of social tipping dynamics where, you know, the first person protesting, it's quite a bold move, and you might get, you know, stamped on by the police or whatever, but you make it incrementally easier for the next person to protest and join you, and he makes it incrementally easier for the next person, and that's what we'd call a reinforcing or amplifying feedback, and it's how and why protests can sort of explode in size. So I hope that gives a sense of how you can go from the realm of tipping in the climate through resources or things that we really need and care about, water, food, whatever, to other kinds of dynamics that are tipping dynamics within a society, and not, in this case, not always good ones. I mean, there are other, you can also think of peace to war as a kind of macabre tipping point as well.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the University of Exeter. Our guest is Professor Tim Lenton. We're talking about the report Global Tipping Points 2023. Okay, you raised these social tipping points, and you concluded our 2020 interview with that optimism that good tipping points can develop in human society, and sure, revolutions are part of history. So you end this new 2023 report with the same hopes. What can you tell us about this and about your possible coming book?
Yeah, what I can say at the top level is things are bad enough now in the climate that incremental action is not going to be viable or save us from the worst consequences of climate change and nature loss. And so our argument, and certainly the argument I'm making in the book I'm writing, is we've left it too late. Our best and probably only hope of getting to a good place now is to trigger what I call positive tipping points, which are self-propelling, self-accelerating changes towards the new technologies, behaviors, social norms that we need to flourish in a sustainable way. And I'm talking about things like we now see the exponential growth of solar and wind power worldwide as they become the cheapest forms of power generation. We see similar exponential growth of electric vehicle uptake, whether that's cars or two-wheelers and three-wheelers in the global south. And we might also be beginning to see the signs of a sort of tipping of social norms away from empowering society by fossil fuels and subsidizing all of that, and towards this different, greener future of clean energy and all the rest of it. So what we do in the recent report is try to catalogue and document some of the evidence of those positive tipping points that are already starting to happen at national scales and even in global marketplaces. Also highlight some of the ones that have the potential to occur if we all take matters into our hands and act in ways that bring forward, if you like, the positive tipping points. And yeah, I'm trying to write what I hope will be a popular book on this subject, where I do that mixture as well. I talk about the tipping points that are the good ones that are already triggered, and then I look carefully at, okay, what's the enormous potential for more of these, and how could policy actions and us as individual consumers and businesses and the media and all the rest of it play a part in bringing forward what I would argue are the positive tipping points we need to basically stop fossil fuel burning, shut down greenhouse gas emissions as fast as possible, and get a load of co-benefits along the way.
But we have to acknowledge there are possibly many negative tipping points in history as well. And if we believe the news, a wide array of negative points are triggered now, from authoritarianism to gang rule and extreme drugs. Do you include negative social tipping points in the report language?
We do. In fact, the whole Global Tipping Points report is a sort of, I don't know if it's a giant balancing act, but it seeks to talk openly and candidly about the possibility of going down bad paths of negative social tipping points and the risks of those, as well as trying to offer some a friend of mine calls plausible grounds for hope with the positive tipping points. So we're very cognizant that, you know, societies are complex with many actors with different agendas and so on and so forth, and that things could kind of go either way or possibly in a mixture of ways. On the plus side, at least we're not completely powerless in all of this. I think one of the major messages we're trying to get across is, although, you know, climate change can seem enormous and frightening, quite rightly, especially to us specialists, and we can seem small in comparison, we do actually have some agency or some power to be part of change, and that includes these changes in behavior and technology that could save us still maybe from the worst of the climate tipping points. Equally, you know, other acts, human actions could only act to exacerbate trouble. But again, it's sort of in our hands. We'll be the that are making those actions.
Does your mission to promote positive social tipping points have origins in your belief in Gaia, like a vision of self-organizing life?
Yes, in the broadest sense that I look back as a scholar of Gaia and Earth history, and I see that the only reason we're here having a conversation, breathing an oxygen-rich atmosphere with a relatively cool climate and little CO2 in the atmosphere, is thanks to the activities of past life forms, mostly microbial, and very occasionally some innovation in the microbial world ended up completely changing the atmosphere. Like, once upon a time, 3 billion years ago, a microbe invented, in inverted commas, the kind of photosynthesis we're familiar with that pumps out oxygen as a waste product, and a few hundred million years later that ultimately led to tipping the atmosphere into a more oxygen-rich state and so on. So I kind of know that the little guys can sometimes change the world, because that's what Gaia and the history of our planet teaches us. And I think that's kind of a way we need to engage with our current situation. We need to realize we've got some agency, some power. But also, we need to, at the bottom line, for me, the end point of all of this involves, anyway, a shift in worldview where we realize and honor or somehow value the contribution of other living things to our own existence and life support more than we do at the moment, predominantly in the culture. So, yeah, Gaia kind of informs this thinking in perhaps both those ways.
I'd love to have time another day to talk to you about Gaia 2.0 and your study into the origins of complex life. Fascinating things. But in the meanwhile, the Tipping Point report acknowledges, as you just said, that big social change may not come in time to avoid crossing some tipping points. So what do we do then?
Well, we make quite a strong set of statements to back up the Bridgetown Initiative and others that are calling for a much more substantive global governance and finance response to deal with the losses and damages that are already occurring and could get a whole lot worse as we may pass these Earth system tipping points. So we're pretty clear on the need that there is a need to mobilize resource in many senses to help those who are going to be put in situations that there isn't much of a viable adaptation option for. There'll be lots of others in situations where there are adaptation options, but they also need resource to realize those chances to adapt, to reduce the worst impacts and vulnerability to the tipping points. So I don't think anybody claims to have quite solved or worked out how we change the global governance rule structures to actually effectively mobilize more money and more resource into this crucial area of loss and damage and adaptation. But many of us are sort of passionately trying to build the social and political momentum that's necessary to get to that place. It's the fundamental issue of climate and nature injustice, basically.
I worry, yeah. The Tipping Point report examples, like electric cars, are too narrow, looking for change within the existing system. Now, of course, we have to start from wherever we are, but are we ready for a real revolution if it's required, say, away from capitalism or, whatever it takes?
I agree that I used a quite narrow kind of technology substitution example with the electric cars. I would argue that the tipping point to renewable energy is, as many authors have noted before, not just about changing literal electric power source. It is also about a fundamental shift in political power and geopolitics, because once the world is tipping to renewable energy, suddenly the 80% of people in the world that live in nations that are net fossil fuel importers are in a immediately better economic situation, and they are clearly the majority. That power source is much more widely distributed than fossil fuels, so it'll rebalance in a fundamental way power and in the political sense as well as a literal electrical sense. But yeah, deeper than that, you're asking the right question, and we do in the report go into that territory of, okay, at some point it's clear that we're not going to get out of trouble if we carry on with the so-called neoliberal version of capitalism, with deregulating everything, and those paradigms political are going to have to tip as well to really exit fully out of trouble. So yeah, we touch on that territory, and perhaps you could think of it as we try to cover all that territory and also take, I don't know whether I should use a pragmatic stance, but you also have to work with the world as it confronts you, not as you would wish it to be. And I think by instigating changes that become self-propelling, be they in energy sources powering society or in how we eat or use the land, then history teaches us a bit about how that will probably ultimately manifest in more fundamental changes in politics and power and hopefully how we see the world. I agree that we're going to end up there one way or another, but we have to have radically accelerated action now to reduce the sources of the greenhouse gas emissions.
I could see an emergency where powerful nations finally decide they are going to slash fossil fuel burning, and maybe they will also decide not to deliver any more to poorer countries, freezing their economic development. What makes so many scientists so certain that only a just and equitable solution will save the environment?
Well, I guess we are moral beings like everybody else, and we seek for a more just and equitable world, as well as one where we've got out of a climate and nature crisis. But my version of justice and equity involves other species. I'm an open supporter for rights of nature, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, what to say, really? No one is sure that that is how the future will unfold, but I believe it is. We have some agency or some power to determine, okay, what kind of future do we want to work towards? And I think whilst I stress some of the technological and behavioural elements of that, as you've stressed, that's also a deeply political proposition. So a kind of systems thinker like me has to see it in all angles, I think, has to see it as, well, if this is ultimately a political transition, then we have to be absolutely clear what is our politics, what is our framework of justice for whom and for what, and that's got to be underpinning, that's got to be part of the great compass or whatever, the moral compass, whatever you want to think of, that's behind this or driving this. But what's behind this is people are dying from climate change already, and those people are overwhelmingly less well off, usually in the global south, oppressed by a current system, if you like, anyway. So, yes, all of this wraps around to a sort of systems view, I guess, of several dimensions.
Well, I also think it just won't work, because if you have a lot of poorer people, they're going to see the richer people and they're going to come and either take or ask for their share, and you'll have mass migrations and so on. We won't go all the way down that path. What I want to know now is, what do you want the United Nations to do, Tim?
Well, we've got a sympathetic Secretary General at the United Nations, that's for sure, because he has been essentially putting our message out there as well on the risks of the bad tipping points and the need for a sort of fully justice-grounded response. Yeah, in terms of international action, I think what I want to communicate most is that it doesn't have to take everybody to agree on everything in order to instigate some positive tipping point changes that can accelerate action to limit global warming. What we know is that with the right coalition of actors with a strong interest in driving the change first get together, they can be enough to tip everybody else to ultimately follow in major sectors of activity, like, I don't know, for example, tipping towards electrified transport, or tipping the power sector, tipping to a situation where now solar and wind are the cheapest technologies. Basically, typically, you may need, it can vary, but 10 to 25% of the represented population, if you like, tipping in a new direction can, for the diffusion of many technologies, can be enough to eventually cause everybody else to follow. So smart kind of international policy now is about those who see a shared interest and advantage in making the change happen sooner, getting together and instigating the kind of policies that support change happening sooner and faster, by which I mean, if you're in the transport sector, issuing bans on, you know, the sale of petrol or diesel cars from some year into the future is perhaps the most powerful policy that can stimulate innovation and help bring the price down of the electric alternatives sooner and make them better sooner. But there's a whole load of instances like this where it's small group coalitions of actors that get together